Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with Padraig Reedy and me, Neil Denny, and featuring a pre-recorded interview with the writer Nicholas Carr. Nicholas Carr is the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World, From Edison to Google. He is a contributor to The New York Times, The Guardian, The Financial Times and Wired, and was formerly the executive editor of the Harvard Business Review. In 2008, he wrote an article for The Atlantic called Is Google Making Us Stupid? And this has been recently expanded into a book, The Shallows, How the Internet is Changing the Way We Think, Read and Remember, and it's published on the 1st of September by Atlantic Books. You can read Nick's blog at www.roughtype.com. Nick, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about when you first began to suspect that the way you were absorbing information was changing.
I know that it was in 2007 that I noticed it. I'm sure it had been going on for longer than that, but like many people, maybe most people, I'd been using the web since the mid-90s. And you know, as the web kind of absorbed more and more services and more information, you use it more and more, and had been getting, obviously, all the benefits we get from the web. But I began to clearly notice around then that when I'd sit down, for instance, to read a long article or a book, the sense was it was kind of hard to turn off whatever was switched on in my mind when I was sitting in front of a computer, and I'd start to get bored or antsy after a couple of paragraphs or a couple of pages, and would want to take in information the way the net provides it, which allows you to obviously jump and skip among lots of bits of information, check your email, look over here and look over there, something that is very different from the printed page. And, you know, at first your instinct isn't to attribute these kind of changes to a technology or a tool. You think, oh, you know, I'm getting older and there's probably something to do with that. But I suddenly realized it was so clear that my mind really did want to behave the way it behaved, the way the kind of the internet seemed to be training it to behave. And so that's what kind of got me interested in whether can a technology like this that we begin to use more and more, can it have kind of deep effects on the way we think and our habits of mind?
You mentioned it already, but let's elaborate on ways in which the internet presents information differently to the normal printed media does.
Well, I think there are a number of aspects to the web that are very different from printed media. One is the most obvious, which is that it's hypertext. It has when you have written words, you have them with lots of links embedded in them, and that's obvious. You know, putting links into text is the kind of the raison d'etre of the internet. It's the fundamental technology. On the other hand, it also is something that is distracting in that you don't get. You get in a very much milder form with, say, footnotes in footnote references in printed text, but you don't with the printed page. You're not tempted or distracted by links, and you can't jump around from page to page. And certainly, there are many good things about being able to do that, but nevertheless, it tends to take you out of concentration on one thing. And then there are, I think, other fundamental aspects of the web as an information technology that also add to that kind of division of attention. It's a great system for presenting information in multimedia. So you rarely just get text like you would in a book, or even text in illustrations like you get in a book. You have text, hypertext with all sorts of pictures around it and all sorts of advertisements and even video streams, audio streams. And then the computer in general, but also the internet, is extremely powerful as a messaging system, obviously. So you get the interruptions. And again, there are lots of good things about those messages, but you also get the interruptions that come with email, Twitter tweets, Facebook updates, all sorts of alerts you can program into your computer, RSS feeds. That, you know, it's very easy, and we often find it very valuable to program our computers, particularly when they're hooked up to the web, to constantly interrupt us with alerts that individually are meaningful to us. And finally, it's also a multitasking system. I think it encourages the rapid shifting, not only of our visual focus, but of whatever we're working on. So you do check email and then go back to some other thing and then jump over to something else. And I think all of those characteristics of the web as a medium are very, very different, obviously, from the printed page. But whenever you begin to put information onto the web in any form, it kind of goes into that system of all sorts of distractions and interruptions.
The title of your original article, which came out in Atlantic Monthly, was "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" I know you may not necessarily have written that yourself, but a lot of people would say that, you know, well, do say, you know, with, you know, the way when people are saying, you know, we need more internet access in schools and homes, that, you know, we're getting greater access to so much more information. How could that possibly make us think less?
I think it makes us think differently, or it gives different emphasis to different ways of thinking. There are obviously many different ways you can think. And certainly, the increased access to information, the increased access to means of expressing yourself to a larger public, these are all good things about the internet. And I mean, the reason we use the net so much is because it's valuable, and it gives us, you know, important information, important ways to communicate, and so forth. And in fact, in the beginning of the book, I try to draw a distinction between the content that's available on the net or in any medium and the kind of assumptions that a technology brings with it, I think, about how is the best way for us to use our minds. So even when the web presents us with all this information, it also presents us with the tools to not pay close attention to any one bit of information, but to kind of constantly juggle different things and to, you know, do all of those things I talked about with links and multimedia and stuff. So it's on the one hand presenting us with a vast library beyond anything any of us had access to before, but the mode of thought it encourages is very much one of browsing and surfing, and those are the words we use, and skimming and scanning and juggling lots of things. And it doesn't really, as a technology, encourage or provide much opportunity for what I'd call deeply attentive thought, where you just focus on one thing for a long period. And, you know, that's necessary for things like contemplation and reflection and introspection. And I don't think the net has much place for those, at least as it's organized as a technology.
Is there an assortment? I've always felt that, as, you know, when people talk about, you know, the decline of traditional media and things like this, that people, the way we have to relearn with the internet is that essentially we have to become our own editors and manage the information we take in. And I think sometimes people, you know, particularly with RSS feeds, people set up RSS feeds on what they're interested in, and then we'll get a very narrow view of the world. Is that going to be a problem, you think?
I think there's a tension between the vastness of information the web presents, and theoretically, you know, it gives all of us the opportunity to go out and gather lots more viewpoints and lots of contending viewpoints. And there's a tension between that and the various navigational tools we have on the web that many of us use. And it's RSS feeds, Google search engine, which actually tends by definition, really, and this is their value, to narrow what we look at and narrow our search. And so, yeah, you program your RSS feed, and you're naturally going to program it to get those things that interest you, which also tends often to be sources of information that are fit your pre-existing beliefs and biases. And in a different way, I think search engines, and Google obviously being the kind of generic term because it's so popular, they also have a narrowing function. In the end, their results are based on popularity, and they begin to feed back into that popularity. So if you search on a subject and you come to the top search result in Google, and it's very clear that very few people go beyond the top three, and most people just click on the first one. By nature, that begins to reinforce the top results as the top results for that search, because you go to there and then you write something online, say in a blog or something, and you put a link to that, and that feeds back into Google. And there's some evidence, and I think there needs to be more study of this, that even in academic research, when people begin using search engines to find stuff, actually it narrows, in general terms, it narrows what people look at rather than expands it.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's massive emphasis placed on popularity. I was at a conference recently about, it was organized by Google, it was about how to make your site Google-friendly. And someone from the Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, the newspaper was there, and they said that they had people employed at the Daily Telegraph to spot, to keep an eye on trending Twitter topics, and then commission on that basis, which terrified me, to be quite honest. But I mean, anyone who does work in the web, you do feel enormous pressure to be on top of things that are popular,
right,
rather than are necessarily interesting or newsworthy. So it's interesting. But then the question, I suppose, is who's driving the popularity? Is it search engine? Is it people's genuine interest?
I mean, obviously, popularity comes from the people, but on the web, it can begin to entrench information into top spots. So if I do a search on Google, it's often feeding back to me what the general a kind of average view of the general population, rather than encouraging me or anyone else to go in different directions and outside of what the general population wants. So on the one hand, you could argue that this judging everything by popularity, by the number of tweets or whatever, is just reflecting back what people want. On the other hand, feeding back to people what they want and being kind of slavish in doing it and monitoring it so closely as the web allows you to do, I mean, it has good parts, but I think it also has, it also discourages in some ways kind of adventurous types of thinking that have nothing to do with what people are thinking about at the moment or talking about at the moment.
Somebody who appears quite a lot in the book is the media theorist Marshall McLuhan. If people have heard of Marshall McLuhan at all, they will be aware of his famous aphorism, "The medium is the message," which I've sort of been familiar with for a long time. It never really sat and thought about what it actually meant. So let's sort of talk about that in terms of how the internet is basically changing the way we think.
Yeah.
What does he actually mean by "the medium is the message"?
Well, I think I had the same until I started reading McLuhan. I had the same feeling that you had, that I heard that "medium is the message" all the time. I even used it, and yet I never really knew what it was meant. It's kind of this all-purpose thing that means nothing in common uses. But I think his basic point was that when a new medium, and he had a very broad definition of medium, is basically any kind of technology that we use to for communication, for information, or to interact with the world, even. Any new medium comes along, we always naturally focus on the content that it brings. And so if you look at debate, and the content tends to be what we debate. And so if you look at after Gutenberg invented the printing press, there were lots of debates about, oh, these books that are being printed are horrible, or, well, you know, it's not all the Bible anymore. And with television, there were debates about, are these TV shows good for kids or whatever, and same with video games, and same with the internet. Most of the early discussions of the internet were kind of between people who thought the democratization of content was great and those who thought, oh, there's all this mediocrity out there. But what McLuhan was saying is that what's more important actually than even the content is the way that the medium shapes the way we think. And it gives, as I said earlier, they tend to give greater emphasis to some ways of thinking and de-emphasize others. They tend to, one thing he pointed out was different senses are involved in whether you're reading or watching something on film or listening, obviously, to something on a phonograph. So the medium, he said, ultimately the message that a new medium broadcasts into society is not the content it's broadcasting, but the way it's encouraging us to think and to interact and to socialize.
Let's look at an example of an old technology that did that. And you use this example in your book, and that's of Nietzsche gaining a typewriter. So tell us that story.
Well, it was in the 19th century that the typewriter was invented. The funny thing now is we don't even use typewriters anymore, but they've kind of evolved into word processors. But obviously up until the typewriter came along, you know, you wrote by hand. There was no other way, and it was a very kind of intimate process. And the typewriter suddenly put this machine between you and the words you wrote, and which was kind of must have felt extraordinarily radical to them. But anyway, for Nietzsche, who was struggling with his eyesight and was very, very sickly man in general, he bought a typewriter, one of the early typewriters, kind of out of desperation because he simply couldn't focus on handwriting anymore. And I think he was very enthusiastic about it for a while until it started breaking down. But a friend of his in particular wrote to him and said, you know, based on the letters he had been writing, and said, this typewriter, this machine seems to be influencing the way that you write and your style of writing. And Nietzsche wrote back and said, yes, the tools we use influence the way we think. And other people, T.S. Eliot, you know, mentioned a similar thing, similar type of change when he went from handwriting to typewriter. The things we often take for granted and think are kind of inert, the machines we use to read, write, to interact with the world, actually do change it in subtle or in deep ways, the way we express ourselves, the way we think.
In some ways, perhaps we could attribute the writing, you mentioned Eliot, and possibly the rise of modernism in literature was a result of the technology rather than the broader society or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always tempting to give too much emphasis to the technology, but if you look at Pound's work or Eliot's work, and it does seem to be something that would come off of a typewriter mm-hmm. more than something that one would handwrite.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy, and we're talking to Nicholas Carr about his book, The Shallows, How the Internet is Changing the Way We Think, Read and Remember. So, Nicholas, you mentioned in the first half the idea that every time a new technology comes along, there are sort of naysayers, people that worry about the effects of television on children and the effects of video games and violence, for instance. Are we doing the same thing here? Are we talking about the internet in a similar way? Let's perhaps talk about research. Let's talk about what research is actually being done into the brain and how it's changing.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of research, independent of the web, there's been a lot of research that shows how the human brain is always adapting to how we use it, and that continues on through adulthood. It doesn't end when we're 20, as we used to believe. And there's a lot of evidence that the tools we use, everything from, you know, typewriters to pianos and violins, actually have a big influence. And that influence is not just in our habits of thinking, but it begins to echo back into the actual cellular structure of the brain. I mean, obviously, there are some things that don't change, a lot of things that don't change about the brain that are genetically determined, but our brains are very adaptable. Neurons can be, you know, shifted in their use from one purpose to another. Certain brain circuits get strengthened at the synaptic level and basically recruit more neurons if you use them a lot. And others, if they're neglected, will be reused for other purposes or will weaken or whatever. So there's a lot of evidence that the brain is very plastic, as neuroscientists say. When we move to the web, there's been much less study for a couple of reasons. I mean, much less study that looks precisely at physical, biological changes in the brain when we go online. And one reason for that, I think, is that the net is still pretty new. And another reason is it's very hard to do these kind of studies, particularly when you're trying to look at media use, because they tend to be done in scanners, brain scanners, and it's very hard to search the net in a brain scanner. But there was one study, and it done at UCLA, I think, a couple of years ago, that did use brain scanner, and they had all sorts of goggles that provided web pages, that showed that even when people who hadn't had much experience online did even a fairly modest amount of searching, in particular, this looked at Google searches, their patterns of brain activation changed fairly dramatically from when they first started, and they changed in a way that matched those of people who had done a lot of Googling, a lot of surfing. So that there's indications there that the brain adapts to the internet, as you'd expect it to, because it adapts to all tools. The findings were ambiguous, I think, because on the one hand, it showed that a lot of the activity that intensified really was in the prefrontal cortex, which is where we, what we use to make decisions, to solve problems. And on the one hand, and the researchers mentioned this, that that can be good news because it means you kind of exercise that aspect of your thought, which particularly as you get older can kind of atrophy. And so it can be good for keeping your mind sharp when it comes to problem solving and decision making. The other side of the picture is that if you look at people who, for instance, read deeply, one thing that happens as you go from being a novice reader to being very, very good reader is that your prefrontal cortex, the decision-making parts, actually calm down, and there's not much activity there. And it's because you're not trying to decode words and stuff anymore. It's not a matter of problem-solving. It's you're going much more deeply into the text, which is all about interpretation and kind of connecting things with your own memory. So that study showed that, you know, we can, the internet may help us in some cognitive ways in kind of decision making and fast processing of information, but may get in the way of the kind of calmness of mind that leads to deeper interpretation. And I think if you look, I spend quite a bit of time in the book looking at what I'll call the information environment that the web presents. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of studies of hypertext and multimedia and interruptions through email and instant messaging and so forth in multitasking. And all of those studies, the preponderance of them anyway, indicates that, you know, a common theme here is the division of attention. And I think we all feel that when we go online. And what we know about attention is that there are lots of deep processes in the mind, the consolidation of memory, where we move memory from our short-term memory to our long-term memory, conceptual thinking, critical thinking, that seem to be activated by the act of paying deep attention. So if your attention is constantly divided, as it tends to often when you're online or looking at your mobile phone or whatever, you don't activate those kind of deep processes that require attention.
Is there, for some reason thinking of, I don't see a film on Monday, Scott Pilgrim, which is based on a comic book and actually made very much in the style of a video game. That's a kind of tenuous example, but I'm thinking what you've got there is you've got an attempt to co-opt this slightly kind of horizontal way people think now rather than a straightforward narrative. Is that going to have to happen more? I mean, we're sitting in a room surrounded by beautiful, you know, hardback books, but will, you know, publishers, filmmakers have to, as news content providers, as we mentioned, kind of already have to adopt, you know, things like narrative to that, you know, that lateral way that people take information?
I think that's already happening. And I think if you look at video games as a model, as we mentioned before, there was a lot of fears about video games and stuff early on. And, you know, there are still some fears and still some reasons to worry about, you know, some of the violence, and particularly when young kids use it. But there's also quite a bit of evidence that playing a lot of video games helps you shift your visual focus much more quickly among different things. And as it does that, it also trains you to expect to do that and to want to do that. And I think the computers in general and the web in general kind of emphasize that way of taking in information, where you, instead of paying attention to one thing, you are shifting your attention pretty much constantly, and you crave that kind of shifting of attention. And so I think that, by the way, this is part of a longer term trend of mass media for the last 100 years, but I think media in general are going to adapt to that kind of desire on the part of people, and that desire to take in information more in small chunks and to be able to shift their attention very, very quickly. And I certainly think we see it if you look at the layout of magazines or newspapers compared to what they were 20 or 30 years ago. And I think we see it in television, where kind of many of the characteristics of the web are beginning to come in, even, you know, putting pop-up things on screens and stuff. And so, I think this will be a general trend, for better and for worse.
We should probably look at ways in which the way that the internet is changing the way we think in ways that are good, perhaps, because we've been looking at it from the perspective that we think it's a bad thing. And of course, you know, ironically, we wouldn't be sitting here having this interview if it wasn't for the internet and a radio show being on the internet. So let's look at some ways in which you think that the way we perceive information could change for the good.
Well, we've talked about some of them. I mean, some are actually cognitive things that, you know, the ability to to shift your focus and shift your attention very, very quickly, which can have, even in practical terms, if you want to be, you know, an air traffic controller or a surgeon monitoring lots of signals, is actually a very important skill. And there's also that kind of intensive exercise of problem solving, particularly visual problem solving in your brain. And so, and I don't think this is proven yet, but we could assume that kind of our ability to quickly spot patterns in an array of visual information will probably get better as we use the web more and more. And again, that has practical implications, particularly today when many people's jobs consist of looking at computer screens all day. And, you know, the more adept you are at kind of figuring out what's going on and what's important and what's not important, the better you might do in your job. So in beyond the cognitive, there's also just the vast array of information that we talked about, which there's a narrowing thing that's in tension with that. But if we look at hypertext, and I've talked about some of the negative things about that in terms of distracting us and interrupting our train of thought, but, you know, there are obviously also very good things about it in allowing us to quickly navigate from one piece of information to another relevant piece of information. And there are all sorts of ways of thinking that don't involve deep attention to one thing, that involve gathering lots of stuff quickly and having lots of simultaneous conversations. And so I certainly think the web probably a good thing for those types, those ways of thinking, those ways of communicating.
To finish off then, and it's possibly an obvious question, but if your mind has been so atrophied by the use of the internet, how did you manage to put this book together?
Well, when I noticed in my reading that I was beginning to lose my ability to pay sustained attention to one thing, I mean, that carried over into when I started writing the book. And so I did change some of my habits. I made an effort to stop running my email all day long and only checked it a couple of times a day. I dropped off of Twitter and dropped off of Facebook, and in general tried to moderate the amount of time during the day that I was connected. But also, and I think this in some ways was the most important change, I started to use the net for what I think it's good for, which is discovering information. But then I often went to different media to actually get deeper into the information. So I'd use the web, use Google and stuff to search for relevant articles and relevant books, but then I make an effort to go to a library or a bookstore and actually get the source material and sit down and read it. And I did find my attention span lengthening, and it was a very interesting feeling, because you suddenly, when you back away from this, you do start to feel mentally calmer or something, and you start to say, you know, why was I checking that information, the RSS feed, every 5 minutes? Because it's actually not all that important. Unfortunately, there's a lot of pressure these days to stay connected in your work and your social life and stuff. And so it's kind of a struggle. And even I found after writing the book that I'm kind of drifting back more and more into spending time on the web and keeping my email running. So it's hard to, I mean, the technology is so useful and so compelling and almost encourages this kind of compulsiveness in us that it is hard to back away.
We've been talking to Nicholas Carr about his book, The Shallows, How the Internet is Changing the Way We Think, Read and Remember. It's out now from Atlantic Books. Nick, thanks for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.